Time to bow, oh, oh, your mind with historical hormones.
Welcome back, my little historical hormones. Today we've got Guy Branum on the pod again, homosexual writer, actor, and comedian to the stars, and randomly an expert on British history, which is awesome. He and I are discussing King James I of England and VI of Scotland, and in this episode we'll be focusing on his gay lover, George Villiers. Now, if you haven't listened to part one of this series, it's the episode right before this one, I strongly recommend you go get the background on James and his slutty Scottish beginnings before starting this episode on his court favorite, George Villiers. Or, if you vehemently refuse, here's a Scottish AI named Gerard to help catch you up.
James is king of Scotland in the 1580s and 90s. He's very gay and everyone knows it, but what does he care? He's got a wife, he's got theirs, and then boom, he gets the English throne too. He's loving it. Doing south in England, Robert Parr is ruling the roost as James' premier court faggot. But not for long. George Villiers, the steaming slag herself, is on the scene. And now, throw off your kilt and get ready to dive in. Cause the weather is wet. Human temperature.
Ourselves tonight and cover all the things that's still a mystery. Cause if you think you know, you don't know. Around the world we go, 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 go. Time to bow, oh, oh, your mind with historical hormones. Historical hormones. Historical hormones.
Just so everyone is on the same page, I'm going to translate from our dear friend Gerard. Gerard. So what Gerard was trying to see is that James was king of Scotland in the 1580s and the 1590s. He was extremely gay and everyone knew it, but what does he care? He's got a wife, Anne of Denmark, he's got heirs, and then boom, he gets the English throne too in 1603. He's absolutely loving it. He finally has a treasury with some money in it. Then down south in England, Robert Carr is ruling the roost as James's premier court faggot. So Robert Carr was this kid that James had discovered and taken him on as his top twink. But this was not for long, my friends, because George Villiers, the scheming slag herself, would soon be on the scene. And now, throw off your kilt and get ready to dive in, because the water is what? Human temperature. Act 1, George of the Villainous Gay Jungle. All right, and we are ready to dive in. Now, if you have been watching Mary and George on Stars, you know that you've seen a lot of this George Villiers figure. But I think it's important to understand what is fact and what is fiction, because he is one of the most represented figures of the age, just in terms of paintings and the amount that he appears in letters and the news of the day, the pamphlets, in England and eventually all over Europe. So he's kind of a major celebrity of the day. He was actually the son of a quite poor family. His father was a squire from Leicestershire, so that in the Midlands of England. His mother was descended from more serious Scottish-English nobility, but they're not at the top of the food chain by any means. He is also extremely good-looking by all accounts. And I have to say, you know how people say, you read in history, like, so-and-so was beautiful, so-and-so was handsome, and then you see the portrait and you're like, what?
Yeah.
Like, what are you guys talking about? I look at the portraits and I see what they're talking about with George. Like, he's got that sort of ruddy-cheeked English, like, you know, ruddy cheeks.
Yeah.
And the deep blue eyes and the curly brown hair. And he's very, like, the beard, you know. He's hot. He's hot. He's not regular historical handsome. He's hot. And he's also well-educated, relatively. His mother, Mary Villiers, manages to scrape up enough money to send him to France, critical for any young British boy's education, where he learns to dance, speak a little bit of French, you know, all that stuff. So he gets turned into the right kind of fancy boy, mm-hmm. that will be perfect for grabbing James's attention.
Knows what to do with a falcon.
Knows what to do with the falcon. Exactly. James once wrote to him, "I naturally so love your person and adore all your other parts, which are more than ever one man had, that were not only all your people, but all the world besides, set together on one side and you alone on the other. I should, to obey and please you, displease, nay, despise them all."
We talking about a dick here? Do you think we're talking about a dick here?
Adore all your other parts, which are more than ever one man had. I mean, here's the thing. I actually wonder if James is more of a cock or an ass man.
Okay.
And maybe it changes throughout his life. I know in the show, they definitely are trying to portray him as slutty bottom.
Mm-hmm.
And what's his face? George is kind of like the dom one. But then there's this whole like kind of Ganymede culture, you know, of like young twinks where I don't know if that holds.
Absolutely. I also think that there's a way that we tend to overlay heterosexuality over disparate power or disparate age relationships in queer relationships.
Mm.
But I think a problem with that is that
they could just be doing thigh stuff.
Well, yes, but also hey, James is from places that don't get a lot of sunlight, so I imagine not getting a whole bunch of vitamin D. And he's a man approaching 50, and I just don't know how much his dick is working.
True. And his gouty dick.
Yes, his gouty dick. And the thing about guys in their 20s, that dick knows what it's doing.
True. That is true. There's also an interesting kind of like way that George is constructed in some of the literature of the time as like this perfect man. Like it's kind of like a Frankenstein mm-hmm. thing. So I mean, not to de-dickify this conversation,
yes.
But I wonder if this phrase is also like playing off of that a little bit,
yeah.
Because he was kind of obsessed with how perfect George was, mm-hmm. like how beyond he was. So that goes back to the day that he met George and the first mask that George performed in for him. So we'll get to that in a second. But, actually we're getting to that right now because that is their meet cute. So they meet, and also just got to say, for the Mary and George of it all, Mary was the second wife of George Villiers, of the favorite's father. So when George was born, he was going to get nothing, like absolutely nothing. So there are stakes mm-hmm. involved here. Like that's why Mary has to put George forward and figure something else out, because he is like second son times two. So then they meet, and of course, George's father dies in 1606. So Mary and George are kind of going it alone from then on. And I think George was only in his teens then. So George meets James in 1614 when he's only 21 years old. Eventually, he'll be referred to as Steenie because...
Did Mary have a position at court? Like, do we know?
Not...
Okay.
Not until George's favoritism helped establish her title in her own right.
Yeah.
So she's poor.
Yeah.
The father didn't leave very much. They've got to figure something out.
Mm-hmm.
So George comes on the scene in one of these like tournament things again, where they're moving around the country and they're like, here's this hot boy. But there's gay nefariousness in behind the scenes here because there's a cabal of courtiers who want to get rid of Robert Carr because it's just gone too far at this point.
Mm-hmm.
He's too domineering, and he's making it impossible for them to make their own money off the king. So they use, as I said earlier, the ultimate homosexual weapon against him to turn the king's eyes towards George, the theater. Now, Ben Jonson, who is at the time the protege of William Shakespeare, is commissioned to write a mask called, which is like kind of like a play, but I think a little more allegorical. Maybe you know more about that.
I don't.
maybe you know more about 17th century masks. But he writes something called Mercury Vindicated, which is all about an alchemist making the perfect man. So this is what I was referring to earlier. And this cabal of Robert Carr hating courtiers puts George forward to perform in it. They kit him out in the richest, most delicious clothes. And that's how he gets introduced to gouty old slobbering dickless James. Now, George is a fantastic dancer. He has great legs. That's like, instead of guys having like cute butts at this in this time period, like they all talk about their legs.
A well-turned leg.
Exactly. It's all about how well your leg fits in that stocking. So this is actually the perfect vehicle for George to catch the king's eye. And catch the king's eye he does. But James is also clever. He knows that Carr is actually kind of powerful at this point. And I think he's also a little bit afraid of him at this point. Like there's some dynamic power dynamic between them. And so James has his entourage bring George slowly into the fold and kind of like put him in a mask there, put him in a tournament there. And so he sort of begins to become the new favorite under the radar without arousing too much suspicion from Carr. And they spend a lovely summer together in 1615 at Farnham Castle. Buckingham later will write a letter to James wondering, quote, whether you loved me now better than at the time which I shall never forget at Farnham, where the bed's head could not be found between the master and his dog. So this is Buckingham referring to himself as the dog, which is something he would do throughout their relationship. And I've been trying to understand this. Maybe you can help me close read this here. But I think what they're trying to say is that what he's saying with sexy overtones is that the master would usually sleep in the bed and the bed's head would be between him and his dog on the floor. But that was not the case, my ladies and my gentlemen, because they were in the same bed.
Yeah.
Okay, good. I just want to make sure I got that image fully. Because, you know, some of this 17th century stuff can be hard to parse. But so James is kind of out of love with Robert Carr at this point. So George is coming at the perfect time. All of these courtiers in the background are so happy because they know that this is succeeding. And meanwhile, Carr gets into a nasty scrape with his wife, Lady Frances Howard. So Lady Frances Howard gets married to Carr, right? And a lot of people are opposed to that marriage because it promotes Carr even further within the English aristocracy. One of these guys is Sir Thomas Overbury, who is vocal about his opposition to the marriage. Now, Lady Frances and Carr and King James are all like, fuck you, Sir Thomas. Go to the tower and live there for the rest of your gouty life, because he's also suffering.
Yeah.
And he's starting to, you know, like get sick. They have this enemy who's in the tower. He's getting sicker and sicker and sicker. He's going to die. And then for whatever reason, Frances says, no, actually, I'd rather just poison him. And so she connives with Robert Carr to get the warden of the tower to poison this guy who's already at death's door. This all comes out. The guy confesses and says he was forced to do it by Frances Howard, and they are both, Carr and Howard, sentenced to death. But you know, for murder. But then they're quickly pardoned by James, who banishes them to the countryside.
I so they're not allowed to be at court. Don't want to anymore. Believe that. I want to believe that James was like, I have to get rid of Robert Carr. Robert Carr is a little too bound up in everything that I am doing. Why don't I, the warden of the tower is my employee. Why don't I give him a story that will allow me...
Fake the confession.
Yeah, fake the confession. And then I'm the good guy because I'm pardoning them. But they have to get the hell out of Dodge. I don't know if he was that calculating, but I would like to believe that he was that calculating.
Could be. I think also, do you think in that case, though, that he's that the poison is still real, that James poison had the guy poisoned?
Yes.
Yeah, because you would have to have the death when you want to have the death.
Yes.
Yes. Okay, I love that. No reason that we cannot believe that. To my knowledge, we too, acclaimed historians.
The only reason not to believe it is that we want Lady Frances Howard to be awesome.
Yes, I do like her as the Lady Macbeth figure, yes, of this all. I think she also becomes friends with someone else who is a big deal. So she doesn't fully leave. I think she lives under house arrest and she doesn't fully leave the picture. She kind of pulls strings and takes other femme fatales under her wing. Also, living in the tower is also not that bad if you're an aristocrat.
Yeah.
Like, you get all of your carpets and your furs and your servants to come move in with you. Like, let us not forget that the tower is actually a castle.
Yeah.
So it's not bad all around, as long as you're an aristocrat. But so at any rate, Robert is out of the picture, whether James engineered it or not. George's rise continues to be meteoric. He's made Master of the Horse, Knight of the Garter. All of these are like are mini dramas within themselves. Mm-hmm. Like, him getting made Knight of the Garter was a big deal. Then he's given a viscountcy in 1616. This is 2 years in, right? Yeah. So he's just like gone up, up, up. Then he's made Earl of Buckingham in 1617. And eventually he'll climb even higher. But this is where we get the sort of everyone striking back and starting to be like, okay, this is out of fucking control already, and we just begun. And interestingly, the one to predict that all of this would happen was Queen Anne of Denmark, because she, as we said, had to approve everyone being admitted to James's personal entourage. And she says to all of these courtiers behind the scenes, she's like, you guys are going to regret this. He's going to come for you next. But if you really want it, I'll approve it. And so she kind of approves it and is critical in the rise of Buckingham. And she predicts how everything kind of unravels after. So it gets so bad that the Privy Council with George, that the Privy Council in 1617 is like, you're out of control, bro. Like, chill out. And that's where we get the speech that was given at the top of the episode, which I think is just like an unbelievable little speech. I mean, there's so much to unpack in it.
I, James, am neither a god nor an angel, but a man like any other. Therefore, I act like a man and confess to loving those dear to me more than other men. You may be sure that I love the Earl of Buckingham more than anyone else, and more than you who are here assembled. I wish to speak on my own behalf, and not to have it thought to be a defect, for Jesus Christ did the same, and therefore I cannot be blamed. Jesus had his John, and I have my George.
This speech is actually what sort of explained to me that James was able to, I think James as a queer man was able to hide under favoritism and friendship as a very plausible excuse for his otherwise pretty outrageous behavior. Also really interesting in this, which is something that you see in Christopher Marlowe as well in some of his papers, is citing Jesus Christ as your kind of divine model, right? Christ had his John and I have my George.
Yeah.
So he's literally comparing himself to Jesus Christ while in the same breath saying, hey, I'm just a man who loves men who he loves. You know, like it's really kind of a rhetorical tour de force.
Well, also, but also he is so particularly God's representative on earth in a way that no monarch has really been, because he is the second or third head of this church, you know, like, and they're like, political philosophy of this time is so much like God is to Jesus as Jesus is to king, as king yes. is to Lord, as Lord is to husband, as husband is to wife, sort of like
the chain of command. Yeah. Yeah. I just think it's fascinating how he's able to like, how, I don't know, kind of brazen he is in these comparisons. And I mean, it was very so the thing about Christopher Marlowe is that John the Baptist, he talks about John the Baptist as Christ's bedfellow, uh-huh. and has these, you know, this is all hearsay because it was part of the case that was built against him by Elizabeth. But he's talking about John the Baptist basically as Christ's bottom.
Yeah.
Right. And saying, and so for James to be bringing that image into play, I think is very telling of how far he's willing to like take these comparisons. Yeah. And play with these guys. And of course, you know, James is like, he literally writes the defense of absolute monarchy. The Privy Council is more than welcome to air their grievances, but he is always going to do what he wants to do. And that is his, as you say, God-given right. Well,
and it's so interesting that like the Privy Council coming for him, truly people who are just there at his sufferance, you know, like these people like have their institutional power is just based on his approval of them. It's hard to come for him, but also I can understand, you know, these guys who are sort of like potentates and magnates saying like, come on, you got to get your shit together. But, and then there's also something just so interesting about like, there's that weird thing about like fucking Oscar Wilde went down for not being able to admit that he was gay. And there is something like trying to understand the mindset of these people who are like, no, what I am doing is Christ's example. And I wonder how much, like, where that fit in the head of a James the First. You know what I mean? Mm. Like, what was he able to admit to himself that he was doing?
Yeah. I truly don't know, but I expect that someone who is as sort of into theological debates and ready to like get down when it comes to an argument like this is kind of playing with his food a little bit. He's when he's making big comparisons between himself and Jesus Christ, you know, he's like, I think the fact that that speech begins, I'm just a man, and ends, I'm just like Jesus Christ, shows how he's dancing circles around these guys.
Yeah.
So I don't know, but he was a very private person from what I've understood in doing this research. So, and also of course it might not have mattered to him to admit those things to himself, right?
Yeah.
It might not have mattered to him in the same way that it would matter to us, because being that wasn't a thing. It might have mattered to him more to feel the love that he felt from these favorites rather than come to terms with any kind of like identity that he had. But it's a really interesting question. And I mean, the flip side of this is that everyone else is talking about this too. It's not just James who has to wrestle with his homosexuality. The entire English public, and specifically the poets, have to wrestle with it too. So there are some really funny poems that get circulated both in in James's time and in Charles I's time, because of course George Villiers will stay on as Charles I's favored courtier. But there's this one that is written in 1628 that I think is funny. Thou wilt be pleased, good God, to save my sovereign from a Ganymede, whose whorish breath hath power to lead. His majesty which way it list, oh, let such lips be never kissed from a breath so fair excelling. Bless my sovereign and his smelling. So it's this whole poem like goes on, and it's all about the king's senses, like his sight, his smelling, his taste, and how they're all being, which is an interesting kind of like physical focus.
Yeah.
Although this was written in the time of King Charles, but they all see George. It also says, take that slime away that keeps my sovereign's eyes from
wonderful
the things that will be the things that will be our undoing. Like, I was actually surprised to find the word slime in 1628. So loving that, but yeah, he is constructed as this impediment to the normal functioning of government.
But also a powerful intoxicant. Like, it makes him seem really hot. Oh God, he's just, to quote Dolly Parton, he's messing with my mind and filling up my senses, you know? Here you come
again. Oh my God, so true. So true. I wonder if that's why there's this focus on like senses in this. Although this is Charles, so I don't know. There's not as much gay involved, but yeah. I think the idea that he was, you don't need the king to be gay for that to work, right? Because it's part of George's intoxication that he, it's part of his ability to intoxicate, well, that he's so gorgeous, that he's so charming.
And it's also making, he's like, there's something very tactile. There's what he has is fleshy. What he has is not, he's not weaving webs. He's just sort of like, you know, impairing your senses.
Yes. Totally. So meanwhile, so that poem was written later in the 1620s, actually in the year that George Villiers died. But back in 1618, he is being made he's giving ever increasingly high posts in the government. He becomes Marquis of Buckingham in 1618. He's then made Lord High Admiral.
All right, let me say this. You make your boyfriend Marquis, you make your boyfriend Duke, that's fine. Don't make your boyfriend Lord High Admiral. Make somebody who is good at winning battles Lord High Admiral. That's when things get scary.
Although we know from history that gay can do army.
Uh-huh, 100%.
Gay can do army.
Yes.
It's possible. But in this case, it was very much not possible.
Yes.
And that will actually become part of Buckingham's downfall, is that he keeps going on these military expeditions where he's like, just get me out there. And just completely bungles everything.
Yeah.
So around this time, like I said earlier, George was a celebrity. The news of James I being infatuated with George Villiers was all over Europe. There's a poem, and I did have the French, but it was old, weird French. So there's a poem written by Théophile de Vieux, who is writing in 1623. And it's addressed to the Marquis de Boucancan, which is some French joke. It may be related also to the fact that con means cunt in French. Don't know. That's my reading. But I thought, let's just read this one. Do you want to read this one? Read the gay French one for me.
Apollo with his songs debauched young Hyacinthus, just as Cordion fucked Amyntas. So Caesar did not spurn boys. One man fucks Monseigneur le Grand de Bellegarde, friend of Vieux. Another fucks the Comte de Teniers. It is well known that the King of England fucks the Duke of Buckingham.
Yeah, I love how it just sort of like ends there. And it's well known that the King of England fucks the Duke of Buckingham.
But I also think pieces of culture like this are silly but so important. Like when you hear something like this,
totally
being reminded that like this is part of a tradition, like being, you know, you learn the name Alexander the Great so long before you learn that he had sex with dudes. You like, you know, there are so many of these people like Caesar who, you know, because they are dude bro man's men, you don't learn until later.
Yes.
That's you know, they liked some man fucking.
Yeah, that his entire army was singing about how he was a bottom. I love this poem because it's like a literal lineage,
yeah.
Right? From ancient Greek gay down to Duke of Buckingham gay.
Yeah.
So Apollo and Hyacinth, that's in Ovid.
Yeah.
Coridon and Amyntas, that's in Virgil, mm-hmm. Caesar. And then we get to the French gays. We should remember also that Henry III, who was king in like the 1570s or 80s, I can't remember which, mm-hmm. In France, also was a James the First. He was a homo and had his mignon, his cute boys, his minions surrounding him. So there's a big tradition of this going on in France. And then we get to the English case.
I did not know that the word minion came from mignon. Like,
I believe so.
Oh, yeah, that is mignon. That is really cool.
Yeah, that's a fun one. But mignon means cute in yeah.
Don't French explain me.
So sorry. So anyway, Buckingham's reputation has grown. It's all over Europe. He is, throughout all of this, it must be said, incredibly corrupt. He is milking this for all it's worth. For example, in 1621, he persuades James to dissolve Parliament. Right, which is a terrible move at the time because James has a terrible relationship with Parliament at the time. He convinces him to dissolve Parliament to prevent in part to prevent an investigation into his abuse of funds, of public funds. He destroys financial reforms that are proposed by some other aristocrat, which are attempting to rein in royal spending because those reforms are targeting his spending.
I wasn't thinking about it, but like Lord High Admiral is probably just, that's the largest portion. Like that's the biggest government spending organization. So it's probably the easiest thing to milk.
Yeah, true. Because they're putting everything they got into their fleet.
Yeah.
Yes. Interesting. And actually I bet George planned that all along.
Yeah.
Right. He knew where the cash cow was. So Buckingham also gets into this disastrous escapade with Prince Charles, which is actually quite smart of him because he has to woo Prince Charles. He knows that gouty old King James is not going to be around forever. So he has to woo the future king and make sure that his position will be maintained. He accomplishes this.
Young rickety Prince Charles. young brittle groaned Prince Charles.
Yes. Young cholera stridden. So he takes Prince Charles. The question of who Prince Charles is going to marry is obviously a huge one in the government, because it'll create a major alliance with whatever foreign power gives up the princess. So they go to Spain to woo the Spanish Infanta in person, which is absolutely unheard of and not the way things are done.
Yeah.
And James also has like porphyria, by the way. He has like mental illnesses at the time. And porphyria is the thing that Mad King George had in the later 18th century. So there are like fits of depression and rage and all this stuff. But when they propose this trip, James is like, okay, fine. Yeah, that sounds like a cute little boys trip. And so it kind of becomes like a gap year for both of them. And Buckingham is like traipsing all over Europe. They're in disguise. They're wearing fake beards. And Charles is, in the meantime, growing very attached to Buckingham, right? Like, who's this fun dude who spends all the money and takes me to all the fun European capitals? Then they get to Spain, and the court is very much not thrilled. Charles tries to play the kind of like romantic errant knight, jumping over a wall to land at the Infanta's feet in her garden. Meanwhile, she says she'd rather die than marry a heretic, because of course Spain is tremendously Catholic. So it gets to such a point that the Spanish court threatens to take Charles hostage, at which point they have to escape. And so it is kind of like, you know, a rollicking fun time for these dastardly dukes. But it also shows how like actively chaotic George is. And then there's very much a PR element to it too, because when George gets back, he's pissed off that everybody is mad at him. And he starts spinning things, right? And he starts making it more about James and the excesses of his court rather than his excesses. So he's already starting to align himself with Charles more than James. And this would become a trope in poetry, in the pamphlets of the day. James's court and his tenure as King of England become seen as kind of effeminate and weak and excessive because he doesn't go to war, because he spends too much, because he has sex with men, you know, all of the great things. And this is where he starts to become seen as a passive king, even though he accomplished actually quite a bit. And, you know, most of the common people really seem to like him. So this is all, you know, part of the interesting thorny question of what happens to James's legacy. Personally, for my two cents, like, I love gay kings and gay emperors who don't go to war. Like, the Emperor Hadrian was super gay. He didn't really go to war. He just went and checked on his armies all over the empire and made sure they were in tip-top shape. If like the biggest problem with James was that he didn't go to war and like spent too much on his gay boys, then I'm sorry, effeminate kings can keep us safe and they have to be promoted.
Yeah, and I mean, it was such a flowering time for art. I mean, he gave us the Bible, the English Bible that we still use, you know?
Yeah. Yes, Totally. And that was like not a small thing, right? Like that was a momentous occasion for Protestant England. You mentioned earlier that Elizabeth had the Book of Common Prayer, or no, maybe it was Edward, or one of them. They sort of like helped, you know, the Protestant revolution along in England by providing that. But people literally couldn't read the Bible, and reading the Bible was the whole point of being a Protestant, right? Having direct access to the scripture. So James kind of changed the world with that. So it can't just be shoved under the rug. The other critical thing that George accomplished, thanks to his mother Mary, was a very strategic marriage to Lady Catherine Manners, who was known as the richest girl in the land outside of the royal family.
Wonderful.
So they get married. I mean, it's pretty much the best he could do.
Yeah.
So they get married in 1620. And then there's this funny letter that James sends him where he's like, oh my God, I love you guys. I hope that she's pregnant already, et cetera, et cetera. When you get up, like, come find me, basically, you know? And he's just like, I'm waiting. And he also mentions in that letter that he hopes that George will not forget to read over again his former letter, which is very tantalizing. I don't know what that former letter is or if we have it. But they clearly still have this like secret relationship going on. And actually the letters are how we know a lot of this. The letters are like a lot of the evidence.
Yeah.
They always refer to each other in these pet names of like dad and gossip. gossip apparently means, comes from godparent and means like, you know, your friend, your buddy. George, signs his letters, your most humble slave and servant and dog, Steenie. I'm not sure if I explained that before, but Steenie was from St. Stephen because in the Bible, St. Stephen is said to have the face of an angel. So naturally Buckingham is Steenie. And like, you know, servant, totally normal thing to say to your royal overlord. Slave, actually going a bit far. And dog, definitely further than what most people would say. So like, I think we have to read something.
I love it. They're playing power games. They're having fun. And also that weird thing of what do you want out of your like king favorite relationship 10, 20 years in when he's got a wife? I mean, I do love that James just like wants to be remembered.
Yes, that's so true. And actually, I mean, I guess we talk a lot about like who's fucking whomst and all of that, but it's like the love part of this, I think, is real.
Yeah.
Like whether or not they're doing sex to one another, like they loved each other, or at least James loved him. And I think Buckingham loved him back in some way.
No.
I mean, he certainly owed his entire life to him.
I think the love is real. The one sort of like big realization I had from this whole podcast was realizing that the kind of guy who plays the Game of Thrones hard enough to become a favorite is never going to be a good administrator. That is where we have the bad side, where like lesbians, like the first Duchess of Marlborough, like, she's good at the job. Like,
she's in charge.
Lesbians, she's got it together, you're going to have somebody with a wrench in one hand and the royal seal in the other hand just being like, can I fix this country? And
getting to work.
Like, you know, here you've got George Villiers at, like, 40 trying to hoist Prince Charles to hop over the wall in Spain, you know? It's not practical.
Yes, no, so true, so true. And I mean, what's interesting also to me is that throughout all of George's bad behavior, like James kind of just doubles down. There doesn't seem to be a souring in their relationship.
Yeah.
So that also says something to me about the nature of the love between them.
Yeah.
I mean, some of these letters are like, James is very like the besotted lover, you know, he writes that I do nothing but weep and mourn because you left me. Like, how can I harden my heart against thy absence? All of this stuff. And the language that he's speaking in, and the love is expansive also, by the way, it's not exclusive.
Yeah.
Like there are other favorites and he brings George's new wife, the rich girl, the heiress into this. He wants George to have a family and a dynasty. So in a way he's like not a selfish asshole also, which is kind of nice. So anyway, we know about the extent of this relationship, be it sexual or not, it was. We know about it from these letters. James dies in 1625. He is deeply unwell. And he leaves things in kind of a shambles, right? And we all know it's not going to go great for Charles in the rest of his reign. But I think that part of that is somewhat due to the unrest that Buckingham was in part responsible for. There are, like I said, all of these military escapades, like they try to recover the electorate of the Palatinate in 1624. That doesn't go well. They try to go war against France in La Rochelle ostensibly to help the French Huguenots, who are also, you know, who are French Protestants, much persecuted in France. And that's disastrous. And like all of the Brits die. And then that actually leads to Buckingham's undoing, because he goes to Portsmouth to try to quell some of the unrest. And one of these guys, a disgruntled soldier, takes it upon himself to liberate the nation from George. And one morning in the captain's house in Portsmouth in 1628, Buckingham leaves the room, and then this guy, John Felton, leaps forward and stabs him in the chest.
Oh, wow.
And then Buckingham, of course, has a dramatic last line where he goes, "The villain hath killed me," and pulls the dagger out of the wound and staggers forward a few steps and then completely collapses, blood everywhere. Actually, not totally dissimilar to Christopher Marlowe's undoing, interestingly. Lots of stabbing in pubs and public houses and the such. So by this point, Charles is king. Buckingham was very much a father figure to him. He's distraught, but meanwhile, the London masses light celebratory bonfires, and crucially, the news gets back to Mary Villiers, his mother, and she apparently, the reports are that she sort of responded to it like she had been expecting it. Like she doesn't even cry, like that level. And so George is buried next to James in Westminster Abbey. I think you can still go see his golden effigy, which features a motto in Latin that means "the enigma of the world," which I think is pretty fabulous. That's actually
very gay.
Kind of a mic drop. So that's it. That's the story. That's the true story of George. Act two. Does anyone care? Okay, I think that you can tell from the two homosexuals going back and forth about British history for an hour and a half here that we do care. We do, in fact, care. But I want to ask what your take is, Guy, on James I at the end of this podcast episode. Did you learn anything new? Do you have like a different conception of him? And then I'm going to share mine as well.
I think of him as sweeter. Like I had truly always thought of him. Like I think the Stuart men tend to not be great administrators. And he's probably the most successful of all of them. But like, I think that I now appreciate more what a vulnerable place emotionally he was in, and what he was looking for out of men and religion.
No, and I think, to be honest, I didn't really know much about him except as the gay one that came after Elizabeth. So I was mostly interested, and obviously, like I said, I knew a bit about Mary, Queen of Scots, so I was mostly interested to kind of get into his psychology a bit, and like, he's really an orphan, you know? Completely abandoned, looking for love. And like you said, like these fucking monarchs get slotted into this role that is not right for them so frequently. I think what's interesting about him is that it could have been right for him, probably. He was actually very clever, very smart. But he got kind of a bum rap with being totally abandoned by everyone around him. And so it's not surprising that he lived his lesbian life of all of these favorites. George, I think, is another story. I knew about him as a schemer, as a user, as an abuser. I think he actually gets a little too much credit in some senses, based on what I know about like English history at the time. I think he was a very convenient figurehead for everything that was wrong at the time. But like, this is a nation that has been divided religiously for almost 100 years at this point. There is a, you know, essentially foreign monarch on the throne after there was a female monarch for a long time. And despite what, how much we love Elizabeth today, like people were not 100% on board with that for her entire reign.
Yeah.
There's an expanding middle class. They're going out, they're colonizing, you know, there's more wealth. They're, the government's not managing finance. Like all this stuff was happening whether or not George was there.
Yeah.
So I think to some extent we need to, We need to deplatform George. We need to realize that this was a fucked up time period and that this little gay boy wasn't responsible for it all.
Also, I think we need to encourage gay favorites of the future to like take the money, take the titles, but don't think that you need to be Lord High Admiral. Like maybe, you know, don't get involved in that unless you've got Duchess of Marlborough skills.
Absolutely. Stay in your lane.
Yes. Yes.
I think that's a good point. Okay, I wanted to talk a little bit about how people did sodomy back in the day, but I think we should actually save that for another episode because that requires its own research. One thing I am worried about is, that I realized while you were talking is that I always remember the Tudors, the Elizabethans, washed their clothes more than they washed their bodies. are you watching Shogun?
No, I need to. Hulu? I need to.
Bitch. Get into
it. Okay.
It's so good. So that's like episode one, this Elizabethan guy lands in Japan and the Japanese are like, are you sure you don't want to take a bath? And he's like, I don't want to get diarrhea, you idiot. So that combined with the fact that I cannot imagine they had very high fiber diets. I'm kind of hoping there wasn't that much sodomy. But like I said, we'll get to that in another episode. Guy, thank you so much for being my British history nerdy. I don't know what you are. You're my guru. You're my angel.
This was so much fun, Bash. I really appreciate it.
Thank you so much. All right. Hopefully we'll have you back soon.
All right. Please do.
Guy had to run, so he's selfish. But before we go, every week we like to remind everyone that statistically, heterosexuals are responsible for all of the world's problems, past and present.
It's a straight apology.
Now, naturally, I think this week we should focus on the true story of George Buckingham's mother, Mary Villiers. In the show, she's very much the monster driving the poor, innocent twink to all of his depths of corruption. It's like, okay, he loved it, though. And so that begs the question, was she all that bad, IRL? And the answer is, I kind of think so, yeah. But maybe no worse than the rest of the greedy, imperialist, toxic aristocrats who were running the country at the time. Now, you may remember from my discussion with Guy that Mary Villiers eventually became the Countess of Buckingham in her own right, but she was born Beaumont, Mary Beaumont, in around 1570, and she came from fairly well-to-do nobility in terms of bloodlines, but had no money. So she marries George Villiers, and he dies in 1606, which means that she is without title or money or anything, right? And not only that, but she's the second wife. So George Villiers' father had children with his first wife and there were boys, so they inherited what they stood to inherit from him. That's why she was so desperate to get George to get King James to fall in love with him. She does remarry uncomfortably quickly, actually, in 1606, same year that George, her husband, dies. Then she remarries again after that guy croaks to Sir Thomas Crompton. Now, what kind of mother was she? She sent her son to the French court. You know, she kind of pimped him out. She was the type of mother who would stop at nothing to get title and position and cash for her kids, which I'm not mad at. But she did do it in some creepy ways sometimes. So, for example, when she was trying to arrange the marriage of George to the richest woman in England outside the royal family, Milady Catherine Manners, she actually apparently trapped Catherine by forcing her to spend a night under the same roof as George, which in the 1600s was tantamount to walking around with a big, you know, scarlet A on your chest. So she was at risk of her reputation being tarnished, and that's why she was forced to marry George. Or at least that's what Mary's enemies say. We can't be 100% sure. She does seem to have been kind of tender with King James. Her daughter, Susan, was also would become a favorite courtier of Queen Henrietta Maria, who was Charles I's wife, French wife, and queen. But before Charles took the throne, when King James I was dying, Mary apparently tended to him. She actually got the doctor fired because she had that much influence at court, and the doctor pissed her off. But maybe that was also bad for James because she herself was not a doctor. And then finally, the one detail that we mentioned with Guy is that when Buckingham died, she barely registered any reaction. Like, she didn't cry. People thought she was acting like she had expected it. So I don't know. Something tells me that there was a deep, dark hole in Mary, and not the fun kind. People described her at the time as greedy and calculating. Again, how could you not be in the court of this period? But I don't know. She just seems like a little bit of a freak to me. And I kind of love that. I love a woman who stops at nothing. Don't really care if you're doing it for your children or not. But so she's got, you know, strong mommy vibes, which I respond to. But something about her just strikes me as inhuman. And I fully believe the stuff about her forcing that little slut to spend the night with George under the same roof. So we apologize for Mary Villiers. We apologize for the evil that she has wrought upon this world. And we'll be back, you know, in a week or two with another hetero to apologize for. But until then, please remember, straight people have always been and will always be the most dangerous people you know. Stay vigilant. Thanks for joining us this week. If you like what you hear, give us a little 5-star rating on Apple or Spotify. Yeah, that's right. Just go into that little app just at the top of the page. Yeah. Oh, and that nasty little app, yeah. Just tap that 5 stars, absolutely just like that. Oh, mommy likes when you listen. And follow us at historical.homos on Instagram and at historicalhomos on TikTok. Okay, love you, bye.